You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Every Voice Matters. Dori Francis here, welcoming you all as we're waiting for snow, rain to come in sometime this afternoon here in Colorado. So I hope it's nice where you are and everyone is staying safe and well. Today, I am happy to have with us a dear friend of mine, Travis Whitaker. And I see I have stuff on my face.
Hi.
Hi, Travis.
How are you?
Travis comes to share with us today 12 years of sustained recovery. He actually began working in the recovery industry in 2014 and then really realized his passion, which I think is his calling as well, for helping people that are struggling with addiction and mental health issues. He currently started working for True Recovery as Vice President of Clinical Outreach, and he can tell us a little bit more about them as well. They're in California. He also is a certified interventionist and has his own business called Living Recovery Interventions, and he'll make sure you know how to reach him for that as well. Outside of his career, he has a lovely wife and three beautiful children, and they have been a part of his recovery story also, I think is what happens with many people, many families. So Travis, welcome. Thank you for being here. You're in Utah.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on the show, Dori. I appreciate it.
Yes. I welcome you here today. I know that we've got quite a few questions that people have submitted, our listeners, but I really want to start off with, because many people have been asking about your story. I think it's important for them to hear what the path was for you and some of the struggles that you had, some of the losses that occurred, and how you've come out the other side to be doing what you're doing. So let's start with that, Travis. When did this begin for you?
So I hurt my back when I was about 20, 21. Playing basketball. You know, I landed on my tailbone, was going up for a dunk, and had my legs taken out, and fractured my L4, L5 discs, and, you know, dealt with it for a few years. You know, I was young, so I just kind of, you know, would get through it and deal with the soreness and the pain. And, you know, in 1994, when I got married, I was introduced to health insurance, you know, and because I had never had it, you know, growing up. So, thought, let me go to the doctor. I'm going to see what's going on, because it's starting to get just worse and worse and achy. So I go to the doctor and they do some x-rays and MRI and, you know, tell me what's going on with my back. And at that point, they start, you know, talking about maybe doing surgery. And I was newly married. We had have a baby on the way. I had got a great job. So I really couldn't take off that 6 months to a year at that time, you know, to recuperate. I just didn't have the income coming in. So my doctor says, well, why don't we just put you on, you know, 4 Lorotabs a day? You know, just follow the, you know, the directions on the bottle. So I did that for a few years, you know, that worked, you know. And then I remember it just, the pain getting worse. And then when you start taking something, you know, like opioids, your body starts becoming immune to it. And you build up this tolerance where you constantly need more, and you need more. So I was going back to the doctor, and I think within a 2 or 3 year time frame, I was up to probably 8 a day. So, and then it moved to Percocet. And I might be off on my time frame here, but I believe right around 1996, 97, there was this miracle drug called Oxycontin.
Yes.
That the cancer patients were taking. So they didn't have to keep taking something every couple hours, because it had that long, you know, extended release, and they could take one and, you know, take care of the pain most of the day. So my doctor started me out with that with 20s. He's like, let's try one of these a day. And I'll tell you what, when I took that first Oxycontin, I just knew that I was in for it, because that was, took care of my pain. It took care of my internal pain that I had no idea that I had. as I suffered from some childhood trauma that kind of led in, you know, to my adult addiction. And at that point, you know, when you're stuck in addiction, I truly believe we're master manipulators. And anything I say is my story and my journey. And that's what I was. I was a master manipulator. And I was able to get what I wanted when I needed. And that was including, you know, my doctor, who was, you know, went to school to treat a symptom, but didn't understand addiction at that point. And just over a few years, I went from 120 a day to 240s a day to 340s a day. And my 12-year addiction, I would say 4 or 5 years was, I was going to work. I was managing my life. I was part of my kids' lives. I was probably an okay husband at the time. But then it just got worse, you know. And then I'm getting arrested because I'm going to multiple doctors. I had 12 doctors I was getting prescriptions from. And, you know, right in the early 2000s, you could go to like an Instacare, which, you know, rather than instead of going to emergency room, go to Instacare. And I had on my file that had back history problems, so I could easily manipulate and continue to fuel my addiction. And, you know, 3 or 4 years into the OxyContin, then I'm taking fentanyl and then I'm starting to drink. And I'm taking methadone. And then I went to a doctor because I had so much anxiety, I started getting Xanax.
Oh, my goodness.
So then, yeah, I've got this whole cocktail going where I've got fentanyl, OxyContin, you know, alcohol, Xanax. And my life started getting completely unmanageable. You know, I'd get dope sick if I didn't have what I needed to stay well. Started losing jobs. And I really started hurting my kids and my wife at the time because, you know, my actions didn't line up with what I would say I was going to do, and I wouldn't show up and I would be sick. And my wife was like, how can you be addicted to medications your doctor prescribes?
Right.
You know, and I'm just like, I can't just stop. I'm like, I don't know how to explain it. And, so she got a lesson along the way of what, you know, addiction does as well. And bless her soul, she's amazing. Coming up on 27 years of marriage.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, I remember getting arrested in the hospital about 2 a.m. and I'm in a suit because I had just come from work. So that was kind of the cover up. I was like, you know, I don't look like an addict, so they're not going to think anything of it. I just have some back pain and I'll just get some prescriptions and go home and be well. Sure enough, undercover DEA comes in dressed in scrubs and handcuffs me to the bed and said, Mr. Whitaker, you're under arrest for doctor shopping. And I'm like, what do you mean? Because I thought doctor shopping was like when you wrote a fake prescription or something like
that. Right.
But it wasn't. It was that I had 12 different doctors.
All prescribing medication.
So when you do... You know, you pull up somebody's list under their driver's license in the state and it shows, you know, like 9,000 pills in a year.
Wow.
It's an issue. Yeah.
That's significant. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember making that phone call from jail because I'd never been in trouble before. And I remember making that phone call to my wife saying, I've been arrested. And she's like, what are you talking about? But I've been arrested for doctor shopping. She's like, what in the world is that?
And your comment about I didn't look like an addict, I think that is a big misconception for a lot of people in that addict is not the homeless person on the corner. The addict is the person next door who's getting up and going to work every day. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, you would think that getting arrested and having some, you know, I was charged with felonies. End up getting down to misdemeanor, and I had a, you know, an attorney that my mother-in-law at the time, you know, helped me get, but I didn't stop. I wasn't done.
That wasn't it yet, huh?
No, that wasn't it. And then I remember going out to this place called Wendover. It's outside of Utah in the West Desert where you can gamble. And I apparently, when I left, I went the wrong way, and I drove my truck off of a bridge and it caught on fire. And I remember a guy pulling me out and Yeah. And the only thing that happened was I did break my sternum, but the guy saved my life. And again, you would think that that would be my bottom.
Call, right?
Yeah. And it wasn't. I was still digging. I was still digging. There was no, at that time, I was so far in, you know, 6-7 years into my addiction that there wasn't a bottom that was deep enough. Hmm. I was so to the point where I didn't think I was going to live until I was 30 years old. I didn't think I'd make it past 30. And I was miserable with who I was. I didn't like who I was. I was not continued to fuel my addiction. And, you know, I had a few jobs here and there, really couldn't keep them because of my drug addiction. And it was easy for me to pass, of course, a drug test because I had prescriptions. You know, I hadn't gone to heroin or things like that. So, and then I remember
that's another misconception is that, you know, these so-called prescribed legitimate drugs coming from a doctor don't create addiction, that it's the illegal drugs that create addiction. And that's another false myth.
Yeah. I don't know anybody that starts off by shooting heroin.
Right.
I mean, I've been doing this long enough that it always starts from a prescription or drinking or something like that. That's easier access. Mm-hmm. Most people would not, you know, in their right mind, just put a needle in their arm. It's not, you know, it leads to that because it ends up being cheaper and they can kind of stay up the radar with the state. And then also I think for a lot of people, it becomes a way of life, you know, chasing that high. It's kind of like what they're doing all day long. But you know, after the truck wreck, you know, again, I wasn't done digging. And, I remember, you know, after that, I was really good at letting people know what I wanted them to know. You know, I was really good at putting that, oh no, I fell asleep at the wheel, or I was just so tired, or, you know, whatnot. And then things started adding up.
Your wife.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because she loved me and wanted to believe me and didn't know anything about addiction and didn't, you know, again, I was getting them from a doctor who's a professional. You know, after the truck, I remember I got this. Things settled down for maybe, you know, 6 months or whatnot. And I got this job and got a new car. And I remember it was about 11 at night because I worked 11 to 8 in the morning. And I wasn't well, you know, and when you're not well, you're clammy. You've got a fever. Every part of your body hurts. Your bones hurt. Like even the hair on your body hurts when you're detoxing. It's the most unpleasant thing in the world that I've ever experienced. But I remember going to work and, I'm thinking, I'm not going to make it through the night. I've got to do something so I can continue to get more drugs. And I remember going around the corner and, I just excelled to about 60 miles an hour and ran into a tree.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. 'Cause that's how my brain, you know, my brain thought. And, so then I had a big brace on my knee. I damaged my knee. So that continued to allow me
to have, you know, medication.
Yeah, to stay well. So then, you know, everything was okay for a while because I didn't have to go anywhere. I had constant medication. And then about six or eight weeks after, I remember going, the schedule to go to the doctor, and my knee was better. And I remember taking off that big black brace and taking a rubber mallet to my knee.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. Took a rubber mallet to my knee before I go into the doctor so I could make it swell. So it looked horrible. So I could continue getting what I needed to stay well. And you know, and to be able to talk about those things now, there's so many people that understand what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and sharing my journey is just about that there is something better on the other side. But I remember, you know, going and they're just like, oh my gosh, it's not getting any better. I'm like, I know. You know, so I continued that for a while until that ran out. Lost that job. And then I remember breaking my finger. I don't know if you can see that, but this one right here will never heal because I took a hammer to it to continue to get, you know, medications.
So self-abuse on top of self-abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the cycle of it. You know, the disease of addiction is definitely baffling. And then, you know, during that time, I think, you know, to be able to, then I got a drug dealer that I met. Then I started doing like title loans for cars that were paid for at 300%. That's such a bright idea, right? In my mind, you know, go get $2,500 at 300% interest. And then that cycle would continue to worry about lose our cars and family would come in and bail us out. And then I'd continue to do that. And then in about, 2000, I think it was about 2008. I'm going to go back a little bit, 2007. My real dad gave me it for adoption to my mom's new husband when I was about 4 years old. And all he wanted was $4,000. So then, you know, I was adopted, my name changed. You know, he was an alcoholic. So that's kind of where all this, the childhood trauma came into was,
not
my mom, I
wanted.
Loved. Yeah. 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 And, you know, and just, you know, just guys that weren't, you know, didn't have the best in intentions. And, so that led into it. But, you know, I remember just after we had our son, I looked my real dad up and because he lived in just the Salt Lake Valley and I hadn't seen him for 21 years and I wanted to know who he was. You know, I feel like there was something missing there. And I go meet him and, you know, he's a basketball player like me. You know, he was a big guy, 6'9", and multiple surgeries, addicted to pills. Mm. And I was like, you know, there's got to be something to this DNA or to this, you know, where it kind of runs in the family.
Yeah.
Because I don't even know this guy, but yet I'm almost exactly like him. And I'm almost heading down that same path where he's been divorced 9 times. He's living in his mom's basement. He's a drug addict. You know, try to get to know him. And I think I was probably forcing that relationship a little bit. And a year or so after, you know, getting to know him, I remember that he was high or he was hallucinating or something. And I got a phone call that was like a death threat. It was really interesting and really strange. And so I go over to his house and I show up banging on the door and he pulls a gun on me. And he pulled the trigger and it didn't go off. And wow. It was loaded. Yeah. Yeah. And it was loaded. And I'll never forget that. So I think that that helped into my addiction again, continuing to feel it because here I am always wondering about my dad. I meet him and my expectations were just not what I thought. He wasn't a good guy. And I always told myself growing up, I'm going to be a great father. I'm going to be a great husband, you know, and then that 12 years of addiction. But, you know, all of that is kind of leading up to, you know, in 2009, I remember my wife and I, just not getting along, obviously. I mean, life's not good. She doesn't know how to do it. She's working full time, paying all the bills, taking care of 3 kids, doing everything. I'm sleeping on the couch for years. And we,
too.
Yeah. And we pretty much became roommates. Yeah. You know, that's what we were. And she was my babysitter, to be honest. Because she would, every time I'd leave, she always wondered if she was going to get that knock at the door saying I'm dead. During that time I had a massive seizure, coming off the Xanax and didn't know who I was for 5 days. So there was just so many, you know, in the overdoses and, you know, the ER visits in there. But on a Thursday in 2009, I believe it was probably like April 16th or so, I remember calling my doctor to get my Xanax filled and I was getting 120 a month. So my doctor called in a refill. I go pick it up and I guess I had one refill that was already done and they gave me 2 bottles of 120. Wow. And if you're an addict, you're just like, that's like, you're so excited.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like Disneyland. You're like, are you kidding me?
I just won the lottery.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, and I was just imploding. I wasn't happy with who I was. I wasn't being a father. I wasn't being a husband. I wasn't providing. I wasn't a good friend. All the neighbors knew what was going on from the wrecks and the cops being at the house all the time. And so that I just remember taking over a 3-day period, all of them. I took all 220 of them. I mean, I remember I could take 20 at a time, 25 at a time. I'm not a small guy. I'm 6'5", and at the time 250, and years of abuse. That's just what you do. It's never one or two. It's a handful. We got in an argument, and I remember throwing all my clothes in the car. And for some reason, my outlet was always to take off to the West Desert. I don't know why. That's where the casinos were. That's where I thought my life was going to be amazing and change. And I kind of remember getting a little tired. So I rolled the window down, turned the music up really loud. And sure enough, I kind of wake up a little bit to have kind of like the jaws of life bringing me out of my car, because I had rolled so many times. I was doing 120.
Oh, geez.
So I remember a glimpse of that. Don't remember anything else other than being in the hospital. And this is something that I just will, that's affected my life for the better. I remember looking down at myself, and I'm just kind of, you know, they're cutting my shirt, and they got the paddles, and I'm just like, what the hell's going on? And I get a smack in the back of the head, and I look over, and it's my guardian angel, who over these years has kept me
alive. You know,
kept me alive.
Yes.
And I remember looking over, and he goes, I'm done. It's like, I'm done. Do you get it? You know, because I guess looking down, I'm supposed to be like, yeah, I get it. And I'm just like, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. He goes, you got three choices. One is I'm going to let you die on the table and basically set everybody free in your family, because this is just destroying everybody. Two, you can keep going the way you're going, and you're going to end up killing somebody, and you're going to go to prison for it. And again, I think every day I never had my kids, or I'd never hurt anybody. Or three, you can find recovery. And I must have chose three, because I remember leaving the hospital. I think it was about a day later. They were just like, I guess I wasn't the most pleasant person to be around. So
I
left the hospital, and I was somehow in the waiting room on the floor, and the cops are kicking me out. I don't know how all that took place, but I remember walking a couple miles in Tooele, Utah, to a little car dealership. Told the guy I was in a wreck. Cops told me that my car was impounded and totaled at this wreck yard down the street. This guy was so nice, drove me to the wreck yard, got some clothes, went back to my house, and the cops were waiting for me there. Mm. And saying, you know, your wife doesn't want you around. And at that point, I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I'm just hurting everybody. So my best friend came and got me. I went and stuck in... stayed at his house for a couple weeks while my wife was reaching out to our bishop and whoever she could to help give me some treatment. And the weirdest thing is how much drugs I had in my system. I never detoxed. I never went through withdrawals. I can't explain it. I don't know if the out-of-body life-changing experience just changed my direction. But I spent the next 2 weeks living there and really thinking about my life and the gift I've been given to be alive and the changes I want to make
multiple times.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I went and did in residential treatment for 95 days and, never looked back. But of course, you know, when you get out of residential, I had removed all the drugs and alcohol, but there's still life-changing things that you come across where, you know, you're trying to fill that void. You know, I started gambling for 6 months because I was looking for that high until I realized, like, what am I doing?
So just, you know, change one action for another.
Yeah. Started shopping, started doing these other things, buying shoes, whatever it took to make me feel good. So anybody that's watching, know that it's not, you don't just go to treatment and it's a overnight fix. You know, I truly believe it takes 5 years for your brain to heal. Because at that point is when I started making better decisions. What I really focused on those first 5 years was waking up every day, thanking God for my life, taking care of my kids, and just trying to be a better person and not allow myself to make horrible, horrible decisions. But it's a learning process, you know? It's not perfect. It's not supposed to be.
Let's get to a couple of the questions that some of our listeners sent in. And also, if anybody wants to call in and ask Travis a question while we're live here, the number is 323-203-0815. We have a question from Patrick in Maine, and he says, how do I know if I'm addicted?
It's a great question. I think it depends also what he's taken.
Right.
You know, is he drinking? Is it prescription drugs? Is it marijuana? I mean, there's a lot of things that you can be addicted to. So I think it's mind altering. Then I think that I'm addicted. You know, if I need it to feel good, it could be scary.
You feel like you can't live without it.
Yeah.
Juanita in Idaho says, I'm in a relationship with someone who is addicted to alcohol. How do I help him?
First thing you got to do is take care of yourself. You know, I would suggest you get a therapist, get a professional so you can help set up boundaries, because your boundaries are the only thing that can change, and you got to take care of yourself. My wife learned through my addiction that all she did was make herself sick. So I think that's a big one. It's hard. You can't force somebody that doesn't want the gift of recovery, but what you can do is set up healthy boundaries, take care of yourself, and then hopefully that person will want to change because they miss that part of the relationship that might not be there.
Angela in Idaho says, I use marijuana to help me sleep. I've been doing this for over a year now. Does that mean I'm addicted?
You know, it's for me. And again, I can speak for myself. If I am smoking marijuana to sleep, then I would say, yes, I'm addicted. I would suggest meditation, yoga, try some different teas, maybe melatonin, something that, you just don't have to have every night. I think exercising is a big thing. Maybe exercise at night to turn your brain off and help your body relax. Also, make sure that you're not watching TV in bed or on your phone at night, because those are things that I think can help you not sleep.
Yeah, they stimulate the brain.
Yeah, yeah. So,
okay. Carl in Montana says, can I be addicted to legal drugs that you get from a doctor? I think you've answered that in your story.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't feel that that can happen if the doctor is giving them the medication. This doctor shopping, I think, has gotten a little better with the systems that the states now have in place that can track people more. Yeah. But I know that it can still happen very easily, going to emergency rooms, going to doc in the box, changing doctors, creating different illnesses over and over again.
And you used to be, and I don't know anymore, but you used to be able to buy stuff online too. Where you would have a visit with the doctor and they would prescribe it. So I don't know if that's changed, but absolutely. You know, doctors, again, they go to school to help treat a symptom. I believe they're being better educated these days. But, you know, just be cautious, be careful, try to find other natural things. Because I believe NyQuil, they took that and moved that behind the counter.
Yes,
as well.
Benadryl, NyQuil,
some things.
Yeah.
So, there's definitely.
John in Idaho says, what is detox? So I know you didn't go into a detox program, but obviously with the work that you do, there's probably people who are having to do detox before they can actually start treatment. Can you talk a little bit about what that might entail?
Yeah. And actually, I did go to detox 5 times.
Oh, okay.
During my addiction. But at that time in the early 2000s, there wasn't anybody that came in and said, maybe you have a problem. It was, let's get you well, and then you might just be on Suboxone the rest of your life. It was more of a maintenance thing, I think, that they were looking at. But detox is, and alcohol and benzo detoxes are extremely important that you have a professional 24-hour nursing when you go in. Because you can have a seizure and you can die. Mm-hmm. It's very scary. So,
Don't do it on your own.
No, don't do it at home. doctor's license, 24-hour nursing, because they have medications and they need to take your vitals and they need to make sure you're eating, make sure you're sleeping. It's right. Very
detox centers, just like there are treatment centers that people can go to for that specific need.
Yeah, because it's very, very uncomfortable and you get really sick. So I always suggest the only one you wouldn't go to a detox is maybe like this meth, because you sleep it off. You sleep and eat. So there's not a lot of detoxes that cover insurance for meth. But opioids and alcohol and benzos,
Owen in Montana says, I admit I use something to get me going every morning. I work, I own my car, I pay my bills. Am I addicted? And again, kind of what you talked about.
Yeah.
You were up in your suit looking like, you know, the guy next door. But it sounds like Owen is taking something every morning just to start his day. And he feels that since he's responsible, he's not sure that there's an addiction in place.
Yeah. And, you know, that makes me think of, is it Adderall? Like, what is he taking in the morning to get up and get going? And Adderall, you know, to me, is just like meth. It's prescribed meth. You know, it is a great medication for some people that have extreme ADHD, but and used, you know, correctly. But, you know, if he's using it, something like that, or there's also a lot of things that people take that work out, you know, pre-workout, you know, that could be dangerous. So I guess it just all depends on, you know, what he's taking and how much of it and for how long has he been doing this.
Okay. Jody in Vermont says, I'm attending AA now for 5 years. By the way, Jody, congratulations. Keep going.
Congratulations, yes.
And I think about drinking every day. Does that ever go away?
You know, it does. It does. But, you know, with the AA, which is fantastic, good for you, maybe start doing some EMDR or neurofeedback or something that can help you start healing the pathways.
Some more of a mental health.
Yeah, yeah. Add in some more mental health to that and see what happens, because that will go away. It did for me anyways. But I also know that I have to be cautious of it every day. I'm never overconfident in my recovery. It's something that I'm just aware of every day.
So what happens, Travis, when you're in recovery and you have an injury, you know, legitimate injury, and a doctor wants to give you, you know, pain medication? How do you protect yourself from going back to what happened before?
You know, I think that any addict in recovery, that's their biggest fear. Mine is mindset. And I've actually never had surgery until I got into recovery. I've had five.
Wow.
Six surgeries. Yeah, I had MRSA, had major surgery on my elbow and all this stuff. But, and the strange thing is every time coming out of an OR, the doctor hands me a prescription of opioids. And what I've done is I've always just taken my wife with me. And because, you know, if I'm coming out of it, she just knows to say no. But they still try to hand it in case pain. But what's worked for me every time is Tylenol, ibuprofen, rotating them, and ice packs. You know, when you do that right, that really does help with pain.
You can get through.
And absolutely. And I've done it on all five surgeries.
Wow.
Yeah. I just know, I guess, again, it's a mindset. I know where that will take me, and I just don't want to, I don't want to experience that again.
John in Oregon says, you know, since COVID, I admit that I am using marijuana more than ever before. Does that mean my tolerance has increased? And does that mean I'm becoming addicted? And I you know, I'm hearing this from a lot of people during COVID. I think we've heard it on the news as well. We're reading it, that the mental health aspect of COVID, even with gambling, with alcohol, with drugs, it has increased. And
online shopping.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Amazon is my best friend.
It is our too. Yeah.
You know, COVID really has, I mean, from adolescence up to adults, we're going to have, I think, some mental health concerns for several years to come. It's not going to just go away because COVID is getting better.
Yeah.
how are these people going to be coming out of, you know, people who've been isolated at home, working at home, maybe using more than they ever used before. And now some of them are actually being called back to work, needing to be back out. You know, I had one person actually say to me, I'm actually now afraid to leave my house, where before I was outdoors all the time. I don't know what that feels like anymore. It has been a change in mindset.
It has. And I don't really think we're going to see the repercussions of it for multiple years down the line of what this has done. You know, as we've seen, alcohol sales went up 300% within the first, I think, 2 or 3 months.
Yes, right.
There used to be, when they had to go out, lines, just lines. And for a lot of people, that's just a way to deal with things, you know, that are going on. But, you know, I think the biggest thing is when you, you know, and have to start going back to work, maybe baby steps, you know, go in one day a week, twice a week, what, you know, whatever it looks like to just get back on that right path. And if you are struggling, you know, with substance abuse, it's okay to reach out. Remember, it's okay to not be okay, you know, and I believe we're doing a better job talking about it. I talk a lot about men and mental health in some of the things that I do, because we grew up never, you know, being open about our struggles. And I think we need to change that for the younger generation, to know that it's okay. It's okay to reach out. It's okay to have a therapist. I have a therapist. I work in the industry and I have a therapist. Because it's a healthy place for me to go and talk about issues I might have rather than bringing them home. Like, there has to be that separation, you know, my recovery and, you know, my job. There has to be that separation to where your relationships are flourishing rather than, you know, hearing all the issues you might be going through. So reach out. It's always okay.
Scott in Oregon says, my wife says I'm addicted to alcohol. I don't feel I am. Yes, I drink every day, but I'm completely responsible for my life. You know, how does one know? So when a family member is saying to you, I think that there's a problem, just like, you know, and Juanita asked earlier, being in a relationship with somebody, when you are seeing it or you think you're seeing it, how do you best approach, you know, that person? And maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the intervention work that you do and how you help people take that approach.
Yeah. So I'm a certified interventionist at livingrecoveryinterventions.com is my website. And when a family member calls me, you know, again, I like to reach back and go, you know, does the loved one want help? Do they see a problem? You know, what in their life is being affected by it? And from, you said, is it Juanita?
Well, both Scott and Juanita are saying that they're in relationships with somebody that they feel, you know, has a problem, has an addiction problem, and they don't know how to approach them. I'm sure that they might be walking on eggshells. There's probably been arguments and disagreements and uncomfortableness, but they care about this relationship enough that they're wanting to do something.
Yeah. Well, I think also it depends on the type of relationship you have. Is it an open communication where you can sit down and go, hey, you know, I'm worried about you. You're drinking every night. I know you get up and go to work every day, but you come home and drink a 12-pack.
Right.
Or you come home and drink whatever. I'm worried about you. You know, I'm worried about you driving, going to the store and putting our kids at risk. It's not always just about you. If you can have that open communication, then I think that's fantastic. If you can't, then I always suggest get a professional licensed therapist and go to couple counseling, because then you're not, you know, with my wife and I, when it was early on, it was like this, I was right, she was right. And it just didn't work. You know, we butted heads, but when you have a neutral party, that's not part of your family, that can sit down and have you not talk and listen and absorb what they're trying to say and be that, you know, person that's negotiating and talking, I think that's very eye-opening. That was for me.
And that
helped me.
An interventionist as well, when you come in to help a family.
Yeah. So if a loved one calls me and, you know, they've talked about getting help, they don't want to get help, they're continuing to have poor judgment, it's affecting the relationship, divorce, you know, finances, then I come in.
Yeah.
Then I come in, I sit down with the family and talk about a plan, get a plan together. I always like to do interventions from a place of love. So it's all about love and support and sitting down and offering hope and offering help to the loved one that's struggling. And, you know, I'm pretty good at that because I've been through it and I connect with people pretty well. So once we get the loved one to help, I make sure the family gets the help, because at some point that loved one's going to come home. And if you haven't gotten the help, it's not going to work. We have to find that happy medium where the loved one's coming home and not being thrown into the past all the time, because that's a big thing. That's what leads to relapse. It leads to divorce. Mm-hmm. A lot of relationships might not be, you know, you might not be able to save them. But if you have a good open communication, you have kids, you want to make sure you're not passing on that trauma down to them, because then it's going to be passed on to your grandkids. And that's the goal, is to stop it and start the healing process.
Tom from here in Colorado says, my friends tell me I black out sometimes when I drink. That is scary. I'm a college student. My parents would freak out if they knew. Is there treatment without going into treatment? So I'm assuming that Tom is, you know, young. And it's great. He's got friends that are pointing this out to him as well. But it's a little scary. Well, not able to have a conversation with his family.
Yeah, and there's different things. There's, you know, recovery coaching. It depends, you know, is that on the weekends? If he's in college, is that every night of the week? There's IOP, which is intensive outpatient. There's private therapists. There's day treatment. There's always something that can work around, you know, the schedule. There's virtual IOP and virtual you know, individual sessions with a therapist, and insurance will cover a lot of that as well. So that's what I would suggest. Yeah.
Okay. Betty in San Francisco says, I went into a 30-day treatment center last year. I just recently got a DUI. How do I not lose my job and go into treatment again? I feel so ashamed and I'm hiding from everyone. And I think that guilt and shame is a big part of what happens when somebody, you know, is in this situation.
Yeah. And, you know, you made a mistake. You know, that's the way I look at it. And when you get into recovery, I'm very open about it. I don't have a hidden agenda or any secrets, because secrets keep you sick. But I guess my question to her would be, how long ago did you do the 30 days? Did you take a leave of absence from that job? And, you know, usually with FMLA, you can find a good treatment center that can work with them. They don't really need to know the reason that you're taking leave of absence. It could be a mental health issue thing. But with your family, you just got to be open about it. Yeah. I think when you jump on it and go, I made a mistake, I did this, I'm getting help, have a plan in place. Start reaching out to some IOPs, because that's ultimately what the courts want to see. They want to see you doing better and taking this on yourself to find a solution to your issue.
Stacy in North Carolina says, I quit drinking and now I quit drinking and quit using marijuana cold turkey because I didn't want to lose my job. They're now starting to drug test. But now I find I'm angry all the time. I'm feeling depressed. I liked myself better. Is it normal to feel this way?
I guess also, again, how long ago has she stopped that? Because there could be a change in the, you know, in her brain a little bit that's just taken some time. But for me, I think meditation's great. Yoga's great. Finding something that brings you down. Music is a great tool as well. When you find yourself maybe up here and anxiety and you're not thinking correctly. Also, you might suffer from depression. Go to the doctor. Talk to your doctor about it. That's what they're there for. They'll give you some great suggestions, some great ideas. And if, you know, they prescribe a antidepressant for you, that doesn't mean it's something you have to be on forever. It could be something that's just short that you need to be on while you're adjusting. Diet's huge. Exercise and sleeping are all big components, I believe, in helping with depression and anxiety.
Yeah, I think sleep's a big one.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Carter in New York says, I've been experimenting with over-the-counter drugs. They seem to help my focus. Can I get addicted? So it sounds like maybe he's just starting.
Yeah, over-the-counter drugs. So is that prescribed? or is that
getting them from somebody?
Yeah. Yeah. So again, that's, you know, if you're probably asking that question, it's probably something you shouldn't be taking. So I would just be very careful about it. You know, there's no magic pill out there that's just going to make you feel amazing all the time. And anybody that thinks that is just being given wrong information. I did a lot of work on myself. It took me a lot of years to get to a place that I am happy and love myself and know that I'm worthy and I'm worth it and I deserve a better life. But, you know, I've done that work, and Tuesday will be 12 years actually of sobriety. And it's not an overnight thing. I continue to learn and work on myself all the time.
Travis, just very quickly, you know, before we run out of time, I want to make sure that you talk a little bit about True Recovery there in California, how people learn about them, what their website address is, a phone number to reach you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. My phone number is 801-573-4188. And with True Recovery, so we have a 6-bed res detox that we get people in. You know, we like to just do a short stay there, whether it's 2 or 3 weeks, and then get them out to PHP, which is partial hospitalization. It's like 30, 35 hours of day treatment, and then live in a recovery residence where you're given the tools to learn how to be sober. And, you know, with Dr. Markham, she's also a psychologist. She oversees the clinical side, Dr. Smith. You know, I would say probably 90% of our staff's in some type of recovery. So the moment you come in, you know, we're meeting where you're at and we're giving you tools to better your life. The goal is to not ever have to have you do this again.
Yes.
You know, that's our overall goal. It's not 30, 60, 90. It's maybe 90 days with us and then an aftercare plan that is going to continue to keep you sober and moving in the right direction. And Joel Edwards, our CEO, owner, has done an amazing job. I'm grateful to be part of this program because for me, the clinical side is everything. You've got to have people that really connect and give you those tools because, you know, it's if you're 18 to 25, your brain hasn't fully developed, your frontal cortex, it's confusing. And a lot of that, those, you know, 20, 21-year-olds started using 13, 14. So right. It's almost like they're 13, 14.
Right.
So EMDR, neurofeedback, equine therapy, CBD, DBT, a lot of great things. So True Recovery, you can pull that up on, look at our website. Our website's being revamped, so there's going to be a new one soon.
Okay.
Contact information, all the in-network insurances we have. I believe there's 13.
That's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we want to help more people rather than turn them away. And then livingrecoveryinterventions.com is my website for interventions on there. And again, my number is 801-573-4188. And my overall goal is really to get you to have what I have. And that's just a better way of life and to be happy with who you are.
When you say to have what I have, what do you mean?
Yeah, to have an amazing life. Like I'm truly blessed to have my wife coming up again, 27 years, stay with me, to have amazing kids that have forgiven and have worked through their issues. And yeah, you know, and I get to help people every day.
Well, I'm glad you're still here.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'll look forward to seeing you soon, either here in Colorado or
absolutely
or here in Utah. And I so appreciate your time with us today. I think
and a pleasure.
It's, you know, it's a valuable story. And I actually have some people I'm going to send the link to and share with them. They need to hear it. Next week, we're going to have Darby and Jamie Malone with us. They're actually friends of mine that have moved to Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And they have been working themselves, building their own home. And when I say building their own home, I mean from the ground up themselves, fingers, toes, elbows. I think there was a knee in there too. And this is their off-grid home for their retirement. So a lot of insight from them, journeys, lessons learned, some great stories for them to share. And I'd like to end today with the saying, find a place where there is joy. The joy will burn out the pain. Again, I think that's very relevant to what Travis was sharing with us today. And may you all find your joy. And I will look forward to seeing you next week, Thursday, 12 noon Mountain Time. Every voice matters. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.